From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Antioch.
Half Moon Bay.
Yeah, same here, Half Moon Bay.
Coming up, we explore the issues that matter most to the Bay Area's Muslim community this election.
My right to choice involves my right to birth control pills and abortion, and the right to choice of a woman in Pakistan involves not being droned in the middle of her wedding.
Then we'll hear about the first use of negative campaign ads back in 1934.
People who went to the movie saw these and assumed that this was actual news rather than something that had been filmed on a studio lot.
And if election season has you feeling down, some say all you got to do is saddle up.
And the next minute, you can be lying on the ground looking up at the horse and going, what the heck just happened here? How did I get dumped?
Learning life lessons today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. In last night's third and final presidential debate, the main topic was foreign policy.
What I've also said is that now that you have a democratically elected government in Egypt, that they have to make sure that they take responsibility for protecting religious minorities.
And it's widely reported that drones are being used in drone strikes, and I support that entirely and feel the president was right to up the usage of that technology and believe that we should continue to use it to continue to go after the people who represent a threat to this nation.
One group of Americans with a special interest in foreign policy is Muslim Americans, many of whom have roots or family in Muslim countries. California has the second largest number of mosques nationwide to serve its estimated 1 million Muslims, with 62 mosques here in the Bay Area. Last night, I went to one of them, the Muslim Community Association in Santa Clara, where a debate-watching party was being held.
You said that on occasion America had dictated...
There were about 25 people in the room following the debate over samosas and cupcakes. And afterwards, I asked some of them what their reactions were and how they were voting.
Like, my feeling is I voted for Obama, like, the first time he ran. But I was kind of... I'm really disappointed in his, like, what's it called, his record from his last term. And I believe that when the Egyptian Revolution happened, instead of supporting the people straight away, he was sitting on the fence. We heard both candidates, like they had, it's almost like both of them are reading from the same script. We support Israel and the Palestinians, it's their fault there's no peace. I'm still not sure, but I do think that Obama would be the lesser of the two evils. Another thing that's very disturbing about Romney is that he clearly has no knowledge of the Muslim world at all. Whereas Obama, he did display in his first term that he does have at least some like introductory knowledge of the Muslim world. Although I don't support his policies in the Muslim world, I believe that he's probably one of the more educated candidate when it comes to the Muslim world.
Personally, I think Mitt Romney is like a repeat of George Bush, because every time he was asked about something, he would repeat it. Not to mention when they brought up China, he repeated about Iran, about how they want to be allies with Iran based on nuclear weapons, which means that he only wants to be president so he could strengthen his own agenda. Whereas like Obama isn't as big on the Iran and the nuclear weapons. I would go for Obama.
Those were the voices of Abdulhamid Ibrahim and Maryam Aid. The event was sponsored by the Bay Area chapter of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations. Director Zahra Bilu was there.
I have voted Green Party as long as I've been able to vote. I don't see, unfortunately, much of a difference when it comes to the Republicans or the Democrats. I feel like we're collectively moving to the right and getting worse in a number of our policies. I always thought I was going to be one of those adults that prioritized domestic policy over U.S. foreign policy. And now, because, you know, that was sort of like the thing in our community. Of course, like, we care about foreign policy because that's where we're from. Why don't we care about health care and Social Security and all of that? And as an adult now, having previously taken that position, I realize that there's something just incredibly unjust about me fighting for my health care while supporting a president who is obliterating women and children in other parts of the world, right? That my right to choice involves my right to birth control pills and abortion, and the right to choice of a woman in Pakistan involves not being droned in the middle of her wedding. I would argue that the Muslim community's hope in President Obama in 2008 was the result of 8 years of warmongering and really bad civil rights erosions under President Bush. However, I don't think that President Obama specifically recruited the Muslim vote. I mean, I think he, you know, recruited all sorts of other faith communities, but has yet to visit a mosque in the United States 4 years into his presidency. So, yeah, how nice of him to visit a mosque in Egypt and a mosque in Indonesia, but not here, where American Muslims are continuing to suffer as a result of Islamophobia and as a result of incredibly problematic wars abroad and civil liberties erosions, including his signing of the National Defense Authorization Act. It's frightening that the Patriot Act has been renewed numerous times now under President Obama. And what frequently gets left unsaid is that the National Defense Authorization Act, which he signed, is scarier than the Patriot Act. It essentially legalizes what the U.S. did to Japanese Americans during World War II. The issue with drones is incredibly frightening. I mean, our technology is moving faster than human rights law and, you know, and law around the treatment of people who are engaged or near wars. We're killing women and children. I mean, some of the recent reports say that we're creating a daily 9/11-like environment in parts of the world. And I think back to that day 11 years ago and how I felt. And I think we're doing this daily in other parts of the world.
That was Zahra Billu, director of the Bay Area chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CARE. That leads us to this week's installment in our series Exploring the Ethnic Vote in partnership with New America Media. Today, we discuss the Muslim vote with Javed Ali, editor-in-chief of Ilium magazine.
You know, American Muslims are feeling a bit disenfranchised. They're not so enthusiastic about President Obama as they were the last time because, you know, I think a lot of them feel like it's business as usual when it comes to foreign policy. The drone strikes have intensified and Guantanamo hasn't been closed yet. There's still, 166 prisoners that are remaining. So they feel that President Obama has let them down. Now, these are not, you know, all the voters. There's a certain segment of the voters who feel disappointed by President Obama. But, you know, we've also seen that there's a rise in the level of engagement when it comes to American Muslims, both offline and online. There's been debate parties that have been held here in San Francisco and cities across the country. Mosques and Muslim organizations have, they've mobilized mosquegoers and support and the youth. And these parties are usually well attended and, you know, and people are engaging in a post-debate discussions, both offline and online. So I think there is a higher level of engagement when it comes to American Muslim voters.
Do you see then, since there is such, as you say, disappointment in President Obama, do you see a return by Muslim Americans to the Republican Party as they voted for President George W. Bush pre-9/11?
So, you know, historically, I think Muslims have aligned themselves with the Republican Party because they felt that their values were closely aligned. But, you know, this change has happened, especially in a post-9/11 world. In the past election cycles, we've definitely seen the shift. And I don't think that they're going to go back to the Republican Party, mainly because it seems like the Republican Party has kind of adopted an agenda that's anti-Muslim. But there's a lot of, anti-Muslim sentiment in the country. And Muslims also, they realize that change does not happen overnight. It takes time, especially when it comes to institutional change.
What's the role of Islamophobia this year? It's been a big issue for these past couple of years and the anti-Sharia movement in many states. And there's just this sense that there's a heightened sense of kind of anti-Muslim sentiment. How does that play into how people vote?
You know, it's not a secret, right? Islamophobia exists, and it's an industry that has realized that this is a lucrative, this is a lucrative industry pretty much when you're mining and marginalizing the Muslim American community, and they're making money off of it. So, and it's rampant in the Republican Party as well. So I think going back, when you look at the pizza magnate Herman Cain, he vowed not to appoint any Muslims in his cabinet if he were to be elected. Or you look at the former speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, who claimed that Palestinians are an invented people. You know, so there's been certainly a lot of cases, that have been reported on. And I think this is definitely affecting the way that Muslims are going to vote because, you know, they don't feel like that are aligned to the Republican Party.
Okay, so let's talk about local candidates, Bay Area, California. Who is the Muslim community excited about?
If there's Aziz Ansari, he's running for office in the city of Fremont, and I think, you know, he's one to watch. There's a political blog from the city of Fremont that labeled him a game changer. So he's a fresh face, and he believes that due to the city's poor strategy, bad policies, and lack of leadership, it's caused a significant lapse where the city of Fremont stands when you look at, you know, the Silicon Valley. He's addressing the issue by saying that he's going to provide better fiscal management, bring in new businesses, drive the creativity and innovation that has lacked over the past few years.
And so let's talk about some ballot initiatives and just local issues. What propositions are being followed by the community?
You know, while I think that foreign policy remains a pressing issue, when you look at local measures, Prop 37, that would require companies to label all foods that have been made with genetically modified ingredients. There's also Prop 35 that would toughen the penalties for sex trafficking and those that are convicted of the crime, you know, and rightfully so. And Muslims are also interested in measures that are related to the flow of special interest money into elections. You know, I think that this is going to be something that's going to directly affect the Muslim community in years to come, because of the forces that are driven to minimize the role of Muslims in the mainstream. And this, again, takes back to the Islamophobia industry that exists and the money that's being pumped into the special interest groups.
So overall, are you expecting a lower turnout to the vote? Yesterday, I spoke to some people, and some of them were just like, you know what, I feel like Obama and Romney pretty much will do the same and have the same policies in terms of Muslim Americans and the Muslim world. President Obama hasn't repealed the Patriot Act. He hasn't closed Guantanamo Bay and all these other things. And the drone attacks are continuing in Pakistan. I don't feel a difference between the two, and I just won't vote. Are you hearing that?
We certainly are hearing that. And, you know, there's a report that the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding is a think tank based out of Santa Clara. They released a report earlier this year called Engaging American Muslims. And they've determined that there's about 1.2 million American Muslims who are registered voters. And, you know, votes that are going to be cast in the battleground states also has a large American Muslim population. So I think we have seen a rise in the level of engagement when it comes to American Muslim voters. There are certainly segments that are going to vote for the third party candidate, but I don't think there's going to be a lower turnout overall.
That was Javed Ali, editor-in-chief of Newark-based Ilum magazine, talking about the American Muslim vote. There are only a couple of them left, but every Tuesday till Election Day, we will continue our Ethnic Voter series in partnership with New America Media. As Election Day draws nearer, we want to know whose foreign policy plan appeals more to you. Call our feedback line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Leave a message and you may hear yourself on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. While you can't cast your physical vote until Election Day, there are many ways to support your candidates or propositions of choice before November 6th. You can obviously give your time by volunteering to call potential voters or hand out leaflets. And campaigns will always welcome the contribution of your hard-earned cash. This last way to show your support has gotten a lot of attention since the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling back in 2010. Citizens United allows corporations and unions to give unlimited amounts of money to political campaigns, saying it's their right under the First Amendment to do so. This move to basically recognize corporations as individuals incensed many activists who say this decision threatens the democratic process. Many took to the streets in protest, but here in the Bay Area, citizens of San Francisco took to the beach. KALW's Leela Day was there.
It's early October, and about 1,000 people are gathered at Ocean Beach in San Francisco. They're occupying about a half mile of the beach, sprawled out in the sand, staring at the sky where a helicopter is flying back and forth. From above, you can see that the bodies spell out Dump Citizens United. And a photographer hangs off the side of a chopper, sort of resembling a soldier on patrol.
As far as you can go, spread out. Head for the bridge.
And then you're standing on the beach and there's a line a mile long of people, and then it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't stuck my neck out. Oh, God, I'm going to cry.
The organizer of today's event is Brad Newsham, a San Francisco cab driver. He combs the beach, making sure everyone stays in position. He hopes to create an image and spread a message that will circulate nationwide.
That's the worst Supreme Court decision ever, and it is. They say money is speech. Corporations are people. Let's have an auction instead of an election.
On the beach, over by the letter P, these people have this to say.
When corporations meddle in politics, greed wins out, and people's needs end up getting sacrificed.
It's all about, government for the people, by the people. It's not a government for the corporations, by the corporations.
You know, if we want to overturn a horrible Supreme Court decision, we can do that.
When the chopper finally whizzes away, people gather their belongings and scatter in different directions, all of them hoping that the human SOS they spelled out on the beach will actually get someone's attention. For Cross Currents, I'm Leela Day.
There's a measure on the San Francisco city ballot this year that gives voters a chance to speak out against Citizens United. Proposition G is a, quote, policy declaration that supports limits on political campaign contributions and spending and opposes artificial corporate rights and giving corporations the same rights entitled to human beings, end quote. If passed, Prop G would be non-binding, but it would put the city on record against the Supreme Court decision. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Most people would agree that Citizens United was a turning point for campaign finance in the United States, paving the way for super political action committees to inject record amounts of anonymous donations into this year's election. Another turning point for the American electoral process was the first use of broadcast media to sway public opinion. Today, it's hard to imagine an election cycle without the use of negative campaign ads. But back in 1934, it was a novel idea, one that proved deadly to the candidacy of Upton Sinclair in the California race for governor. Yes, the same Upton Sinclair who famously exposed Chicago's brutal meatpacking industry in his novel, The Jungle. In 1934, the threat of a socialist like Sinclair gaining the state's highest office led to an unprecedented media campaign to stop him. KALW's Art Persico has more in this story from our archives.
It's 1934, 5 years into the Great Depression. California's industry and agriculture had been hit especially hard. Farmers were getting low prices for their crops. Many workers lost their jobs as factories closed. Californians were desperate for a leader with vision. Enter Upton Sinclair. The prolific writer had previously run for national and state office several times as a socialist, but without success. Now a Democrat, Sinclair emerged as a politician with the right message at the right time, says San Francisco State University historian Robert Cherney.
The nation was in a serious situation by the early 30s. For the first time, here was a candidate for office in California saying, I have a plan to get you out of the economic situation that you're in.
Upton Sinclair, here in a 1962 lecture, remembers his 1934 campaign.
70,000 people in the state of California were admittedly starving. And the proposition came to me to run for governor on a program of production for use instead of for the profit of the big business interests.
Sinclair proposed a government-run statewide system of farm and factory co-ops.
Let the state put up the money, let the workers go in and work the factories and sell the goods and get the money to buy food. That was, in short, the EPIC program. EPIC means End Poverty in California.
Sinclair traveled all over the state starting EPIC clubs. His ideas inspired thousands of Californians who took up his vision.
They built an enormous political movement. We had EPIC groups in every old town and village in the state of California, everywhere as I went. As I say, the thing grew until it became a tidal wave.
1,000 EPIC volunteers registered 350,000 new Democratic voters between January and August of 1934. In the Democratic primary that month, Sinclair beat his opponent, George Creel, a conservative Democrat, by a margin of almost 2-1. In fact, Sinclair received almost 100,000 more votes in his primary than incumbent Governor Frank Merriam received in the Republican primary. With the gubernatorial election just 3 months away, Upton Sinclair found himself in a good position to become the next governor of California.
Good times are surely coming. All business will be humming, and we'll give old poverty the air. If this epic plan is phony, then the rest is all baloney. So vote for Downey and Upton Sinclair.
But not everybody was happy about the sudden rise of the populist leader.
It just scared the wits out of the politicians and the big businessmen who run the state of California.
Historian Robert Cherney says that fear also mobilized Sinclair's opposition.
Having this former socialist campaigning on a radical platform as a Democratic candidate brought the Republicans a great deal of campaign funding that they hadn't had before.
The party used that money to hire the first modern political campaign consultants. One-time reporters Clem Whitaker and Leon Baxter were a married couple who founded Campaigns Incorporated. In their first project in 1933, they developed their PR skills, inserting propaganda into newspapers and radio, even writing scripts and doing sound effects, in a successful effort to defend the Central Valley Water Project against PG&E's opposition and huge resources. And they won. Emboldened by their success, they took their media campaign to another level when called upon to help defeat Upton Sinclair. Again, Robert Cherney.
Perhaps one of the most famous things that Whitaker and Baxter did in that 1934 campaign was to mobilize the Hollywood studios on their side. The heads of the major studios were almost all conservative Republicans.
Louis B. Mayer, chief of the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer movie studio, collected a day's wages from every employee earning more than $100 a week to fund a plan that would reach a captive audience of Americans, people in movie theaters. Robert Cherney explains.
In the 1930s, when you went into a motion picture theater, there'd always be the movie tone news or the counterpart produced by other studios, in which there would be short segments of news accounts presented with motion picture film.
Every week, an estimated 40 million moviegoers, or about one-third of the American public, watched movie tone newsreels and those of other companies. Whitaker and Baxter realized that these short news films could be exploited to influence voters. With Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's resources, they created a smear campaign against Upton Sinclair.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am the inquiring cameraman. All day I travel around California, the highways and the byways, the downtown districts, the residence districts, the factory districts, all districts, all for the purpose of digging out voters of California to express their views for your edification. Remember, they're not actors, they're nervous. I don't rehearse them, I'm impartial.
Again, Robert Cherney.
What Whitaker and Baxter did was to create a series of phony news films, so that people who went to the movie saw these and assumed that this was actual news rather than something that had been filmed on a studio lot.
Mr. Duncan, yes. Would you mind telling us how you intend to vote for governor next month?
Sure. I'm going to vote for Upton St. Clair.
I see.
And I will tell it to the housetop.
Mr. Branson, have you decided who you're going to vote for?
Yes, sir, for Upton St. Clair.
Have you any reasons why?
I've always been a socialist, and I believe he'll do the best for the people, for the working, especially for the working people, and even for the rich.
All lies. The vignettes were composed of actors playing roles. Celebrated director Irving Thalberg oversaw the production.
I'm going to vote for Upton St. Clair.
Will you tell us why?
Upton St. Clair is the author of the Russian government, and it worked out very well there, and I think it should do here.
Other performers in the newsreel were identified as Frank Miriam supporters.
I feel that Sinclair is too radical. I'm born and raised in America.
I'm going to vote for Frank Miriam for governor for the reason that he is for democracy rather than socialism. And he won't involve us in any dangerous experiments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson.
Historian Robert Cherney says Whitaker and Baxter rewrote the rules of political campaigns in 1934 by taking advantage of the public's naivete.
They were being manipulated in a way that no one quite understood at the time, but which has become more and more common in recent times.
Sinclair lost the election 1.1 million votes to 900,000. Though he once again failed to reach elected office, Sinclair's grassroots effort did not go unrewarded. 26 epic candidates were elected to the California Assembly in 1934. The state's new political makeup helped shape new legislation, such as a graduated income tax, a tax increase on banks and corporations, and government support for worker-run cooperatives. But the lasting legacy of Upton Sinclair's run for governor in 1934 has been a completely unintended consequence. That is, the mainstreaming of the negative ad campaign. For KLW News, I'm Art Persico.
Which campaign ads stick most in your mind? Do they sway your opinion of a candidate? Let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page. We are KLW News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. It takes a healthy dose of creativity, stamina, and passion to make it in the world of politics. Actually, in most careers, it doesn't hurt to love what you do. We've been honoring the people in our neighborhoods who display a healthy dose of passion in their lives, day in and day out, inspiring us to generate a little of our own. Listener Carmen DeCinque called us recently to tell us about horse trainer John Charlebois.
He is a barn owner, horse trainer, riding coach, person extraordinaire, horse whisperer extraordinaire, and just an extremely passionate person who inspires riders and parents alike.
KALW's Alyssa Kapnick and Ashley Ann Krigbaum went out to meet John Charlebois and his horses. They brought back this profile.
Lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink.
Hi, my name is John Charlebois. I live in Redwood City, California, where I train horses to jump and teach people how to ride. I was a young kid, 6 years old, and there were horses next door, and I was always curious about them. And so I used to watch and watch and watch, and then I became what they call a barn rat. I'd hang around the barn all day. A lot of people say that the most important lessons they ever learned were from riding a horse, because you learn from horses that one minute you have this incredibly successful moment, and the next minute you can be lying on the ground looking up at the horse and going, what the heck just happened here? How did I get dumped? So I go to this gym twice a week, and this lady would always see me there, and she came up to me and said one day, she said, are you John Charlebois? And I said, yeah. And she says, you know, you changed this little girl's life. She was a troubled high school kid that was going through a lot about her self-esteem, her self-image. That's all she saw in herself. And when she came to ride with me, I saw it totally different. I thought, wow, this kid is extremely athletic and driven to ride. And I think horses did that. I can't take the credit for that. The horses did that for her. It makes you realize, if you can make a positive difference in somebody's life, how cool is that? Some young girl that, or some young man that doesn't feel so great about himself, and maybe doesn't have a passion, maybe he doesn't have something, and all of a sudden he has an interest in riding, and you can make that desire turn into a passion, and you can take that passion and you can change their lives. It's a tremendous thing. It's very empowering for me to see that, and the horses do it for the people. I'm just the guide.
John Charlebois spoke with KALW's Alyssa Kapnick and Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Let us know about the most passionate people in your neighborhood. Just leave us a message with your nomination at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Mu, Leela Day, RTM's Konahovs, Anina Morente, Mary Reese, Stephen Short, RJ Sloan, Eva Sonsin, and Anna Sterling. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. Find them online at citycarshare.org. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. Tune in to Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. Our partners at the Fronteras Desk bring us a look back at the North American Free Trade Agreement in the 20 years since it was signed into law.
My view of NAFTA, in two words, is squandered opportunity.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. This is the Hoodoo Rhythm Devils from San Francisco. You can check them out this Friday at Biscuits and Blues in the City. Music starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.